Welcome to another episode of the Confessions of a Recovering Landlord podcast, where you'll learn the secrets commercial landlords would prefer you not know. I'm your host, Jan Gibbons, along with my co-host and experienced commercial real estate broker, Bob Gibbons.
That's me.
Brought to you by Riata Commercial Realty, where we exclusively represent users of office and warehouse properties. Landlords have representation. Do you? Welcome back. We've missed y'all. Hope you've missed us. But
well, I'm sorry. Really, I think that's a one-way thing.
Oh, I can hear them talking back to me through the screen. No, in today's podcast, though, we really have some interesting topics and scary topics, but we always like to look at them as opportunities. And today, we're specifically talking about distressed office building product type and how that's going to affect the commercial real estate market, how it's affecting banking, how it's affecting loan to value ratio. Lots of acronyms today.
And this is actually interesting to me because, I mean, not just because of what we do for a living, but we actually had a client email me this morning, forwarding an article he had written. And he was like, hey, how much is this going to take down the economy? And should I be worried? And, you know, so he was a little concerned.
Well, we've been doing a lot of reading about it lately and studying on it. We have several articles we've gleaned information from. And basically, the crux of the matter is with higher interest rates and decreasing property values and a bunch of commercial real estate loans coming due in the next 2 to 5 years, how is this going to affect the value of the building, the ability of the owner to refinance it at a rate they can afford? The property value is now declined. Will the owner have to bring money to the table just to get it refied? I mean, there's so many different questions how this plays out around the country, but especially in DFW. Shine some light on it for us.
Well, you know, I was actually on a webinar this morning, or I don't even know if you call it a webinar. They're basically just, you know, giving out information from a company that does commercial mortgage-backed securities, CMBS servicing. And so they had an expert talking. And so much like they did, I want to kind of give a little bit of context for all of this. And so, you know, we know that, you know, we had COVID, and COVID had the forced experiment of work from home. And so what is, you know, that's sort of ancient history now. And it's really, what are companies really intending to do from here that matters? And so it was interesting. One of the things that this person said was that, and this person was with CBRE, so he was using their data, but he said that on a national basis, the values of office buildings are 30% lower today than they were prior to COVID.
Well, and what I'm reading is before we're through with this cycle, they'll have dipped 49% in value. And you know, that's someone prognosticating, but
and he said 34%, but you got to understand that a lot of their revenue comes from representing landlords. So, you know, I'm not saying he's lying. I'm just saying that, you know,
that's his world.
Yeah. I mean, you sometimes people will spin things to look as best as it possibly can to their client. So 30% now, they're expecting another 4% decline in values. And this is average, right? So
right.
There's all kinds of variability. And of course, the very highest end assets are not experiencing that situation. In fact, he was talking about, you know, he stratified things by age of property. So overall in the US, 18% vacancy, the highest it's been in 30 years. Or office buildings. But if you look at the buildings and you stratify it by the year they were built, for buildings built 2010 and later, more recently, it's only 13.8%. So there's a higher vacancy in the older buildings. And I've also seen comments and stats where they say, you know, it's not just the age of the building, but it's the walkability of the building that makes a big
difference.
And amenities. Right. I mean, and that's kind of the walkability is walkability to amenities. And sometimes those amenities are in the building itself, and sometimes they're in, you know, the immediate neighborhood. But the more walkable a building is, the more successful it has been in this time frame. 71% reduction in financing. And that was actually, I think, since last year. So that's 1 year. That's not pre-COVID. I think that was just last year, because last year there was an awful lot of loans that apparently came due, and there was still some purchase activity going on. And I think a lot of he didn't exactly say this, but I think a lot of the activity and financing has been the new buildings that have filled up and then been sold. And so they're still able to finance that, but otherwise they really aren't. So 71% reduction in the, you know, dollar volume of financing to office product was pretty interesting. Here was the big thing that you were mentioning a minute ago. You said loan to value ratio is going down. He was saying that they had been 72% last year, and now they're 55%. So if you want to finance a loan.
Exact same building type, exact same occupancy level, well, everything. Again,
everything we're talking about is averages, right? Okay. So don't get hung up on exact this or exact that. But when you're looking at the big picture for the nation, going from a 70 or 72% loan to value ratio to 55, that really goes to your point, what you were talking about earlier, where if somebody comes up with a loan that expires later this year or next year, and instead of a 70, and let's assume that the value of the building hasn't changed at all, it's still a $50 million building. All of a sudden that $50 million building, instead of getting a 70% loan, can only get a 55% loan. So guess what? They have to come out of pocket a great deal to get that loan. They have to feed it to get it extended or renewed or refied, whatever. And that assumes the building value has stayed the same, which of course we know that it hasn't, because as we mentioned earlier, that's gone down 30% already. Mm-hmm. So that that $50 million building is now worth 38 million dollars, and a 55% LTV on $38 million compared to 70% on a $50 million. I mean, you can just see the problem.
Well, when the landlord is asked for their rent roll, and instead of sending over an Excel spreadsheet, it's a post-it note, I think that's going to affect stuff as well, personally. And it's a little scary. Okay, so you were stratifying that for the whole country. So meaning Biloxi to San Francisco.
Right.
I want to talk about DFW. Let's get granular. How is this going to affect this area right here? Crystal ball time.
Well, I mean, it's going to be the same story, different to a different degree. So, you know, Texas has been the beneficiary of huge in-migration. I saw a chart earlier today where it was showing the top markets in the U.S. for in-migration over the last, I can't remember if it was 2 or 3 years, but Dallas-Fort Worth was by far the highest. Houston was number two. And then I'm forgetting what the third one was, but bottom line is, you know, if you have in-migration of people, that's going to prop up a lot of things, because a lot of those people were following jobs of companies that were relocating here from other cities, other states, especially California. So because of that, higher demand here is going to mean that it's not going to be great, but it's not going to be as bad. It's going to hurt a little less. So even though Dallas is not going to have positive absorption, meaning the net change in occupied square footage,
it'll have less negative.
It'll have less negative than the
minus minus.
Exactly.
Less negative. Isn't that a plus?
Well, but one of the things that we are seeing, and again, back to this guy's stats this morning, he said the average deal size has fallen 28%, meaning if you are doing a lease in a building and it was previously, you know, 100,000 square feet, now it's 72,000 square feet. If it's 10,000 square feet, now it's 72,000 or 7,200.
And that goes back to what you were saying about the higher end product is not hurting, because if I rented 100,000 square feet and now I can only afford 50, that's all I need. I can go to a higher price building and still spend the same amount of money because I'm taking half the space, but I get all these amenities that will draw my clients and my employees back, or that's how the landlord's selling it.
Well,
I don't know. I mean, I showed one of our clients around the other day, and two things were really important to them that kind of surprised me a little bit, especially for their usage. They wanted a gym in the building, a nice gym, and they wanted an outdoor area for quarterly meetings for their staff for like a happy hour, just time to decompress. And I thought that was really interesting because I showed them several different buildings and one of them had both those things and they were really impressed with that. So yeah, it's interesting what amenities draw whom.
And they also wanted covered parking.
Absolutely.
But, and they also wanted parking that was much, much more easily accessible for their clients. And so, you know, they're a high level financial services company. They have high net worth clients. Mm-hmm. They don't want those clients having to park out in the, you know, back 40.
Can't miss the dew.
No, no. That's the problem with the new Apple virtual reality headset thing is it's going to mess up my hair. Can't mess up the dude.
Okay. So something else I want to talk about that we were talking about a minute ago is there are funds being created or have been all along. They're just maybe pivoting now that are specifically being formed for the purpose of buying these distressed assets.
Right.
A, are they going to be successful? Are they going to pick up things as quickly and as cheaply as they thought? B, how willing will the banker be for these vultures, dare I say? They're going to swoop in and get these properties. How do you see that laying out?
So, yeah, you use the word vulture, and that's kind of what we've called them as vulture funds.
well, they swoop in, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's not a pejorative term. It's just a descriptive.
Yeah, I mean, vulture funds, opportunity funds, value-add funds. I mean, there's all kinds of ways you can call it or characterize it. But, you know, it's interesting. You know, I came through the 80s. I started in the business in the early to mid-80s, 84. And so I was on the tail end before the bottom fell out of commercial real estate. And we had a serious depression from about 87 to 96. And about 10 years. And I don't think we'll ever see it anywhere near as bad as that. And, you know, building, but the problem with that time was buildings were being built for tax reasons because the investors that invested in them got huge write-offs. Mm-hmm. And so they weren't really being built necessarily for the underlying fundamentals of demand for commercial real estate. So when the bottom fell out and there was no demand and you had way too much supply, landlords had to really start giving away the farm and all the lenders started foreclosing and ultimately they don't want to own it. So they start getting rid of those buildings as fast as they can. And the prices just fell. And people were buying buildings for $10 to $30, $40 a square foot. Mm-hmm. When a building like that at that time would have cost $150, $175, $200 a foot to build. And that was in cheap places like Dallas. I don't think we're ever going to see it again like that because we didn't see that happen in 2001 when we had the tech bust. We didn't see that in 2008 and 9 at the height of the Great Recession. Yeah, property values fell. Yes, there were you know, there was less demand for office space. And yes, there were vulture funds. But guess what? There were so many of those vulture funds that they kept bidding on the buildings and driving up
the price,
keeping the price propped up because they, when you have, it's like supply and demand of anything. So, you know, the supply and demand of the amount of office space helps determine the rental rate, but the supply and demand of money and places to put that money determines the value of a lot of things as well. And the return that people are willing to take on those assets. So yeah, there are definitely funds out there. I've seen them. They've come through my email. A guy that I know started a $280 million, I think they called it opportunity fund. I don't think they called it vulture fund, but yeah, he's done that. And, you know, the challenge with those kinds of funds are that, you know, as I already mentioned, there's so many of them, but the other issue is that for the common person like you and me,
who we you can't, call in common?
All right. For the common person like me and the exceptional people like you, the problem is you have to have a big, big amount of money to put in there. You know, like in my previous life where I was a landlord guy, you know, we had $100 million, $150 million funds, and that was in the 90s. And those funds, the investors in those funds had to put in a minimum of, you know, $5 to $10 million of equity. So it's not like, you know, I can say, hey, can I have a $100,000 piece of that? Well, no, I'm a nothing to them. And it's more trouble to have somebody like me in there as an investor. Mm-hmm. They want pension funds, wealthy families, life insurance companies, et cetera.
Okay. So in evaluating these risks, there's a lot of factors that you've talked about, such as asset type, market or submarket, loan seasoning, borrow and lender strategies. How do you see each of those playing out in specifically the DFW market?
Okay. You're going to have to give me those one at a time.
Number one.
Remember I said common man.
Okay. First of all, is asset class. I mean, industrial is not going to be, I don't think, hit nearly as hard as the office product type will be.
Office bad, everything else good.
That was simple. Okay. Market, submarket.
In what context, what regard?
How is this going to be affected? Is CBD going to be affected like the Star in Frisco?
Okay. So, it's interesting. Dallas doesn't necessarily behave like the rest of the country, especially
we're special.
Well, when it comes to downtown versus suburb. So, I saw a graph today where it showed vacancy in the suburbs versus in the CBDs. And for the first time in forever, the sort of the cross point where the vacancies of those both were the same was just in the last 2 or 3 years. And now the vacancies in CBDs is higher than in suburbs. Dallas, just the opposite. I mean, when I got in the real estate business in the 80s, the downtown was doing okay, but not great. People would go there to work, then they would leave. There was no reason to stay downtown after 5 o'clock. Nobody lived down there. Nobody went down there to do anything other than go to work. Now that has been changing over the last few decades, but still, when you look at the vacancy rate of downtown versus the rest of Dallas, it's still not good. It's much higher. And that has really been the case as long as I've been in the real estate business, almost 40 years. And I think it will continue to be that way for a long time. If they were to take some buildings off the market and just say, you know, they're functionally obsolete, they're going to be converted to something else, or we ought to just tear them down. And you kind of looked at just the buildings that had any chance of being leased. Well, all right, then the vacancy rate would still be lower. I don't think it would still be lower than the suburbs, but Dallas has just always been one of those markets where downtown has never done as well.
Okay. And then loan seasoning, which this makes me hungry. So you first of all might have to give a definition and then describe how it's going to affect this market.
Well, I mean, loan seasoning just means how long has the loan been in existence? So
term.
Yeah. Well, it's not term, because when you take out a loan, you can have a 20-year amortization, but it's a call or a balloon after 5 years, which is what most of them are. The seasoning means I took the loan out in, January 1, 2019, and I still have that loan today. So that loan is seasoned 4 years versus one that somebody took out in January of 2022. It's only been seasoned a year and a half. So the seasoning means how long has it been around, been in existence. And so the issue with seasoning means right now, the more seasoned a loan is, historically, you might argue that means it's a better loan because it has a longer track record of having been in existence, a longer track record of having been paid successfully. Mm-hmm. Today, however, what that means is the longer a loan has been seasoned, the more the nearer in the future the refinancing of that's going to be, and therefore the more risky it is for that owner, because they may not be able to get it refinanced, or they may not be willing to put in the equity they mm-hmm. want. So I would say the more seasoned loans are at greater risk right now, and therefore those buildings are at greater risk for knowing, I mean, who's going to be the owner of that thing. It's a little hard to say. You know, one of the things that this webinar that I was in recently, they were talking about, when you look at the Fed and how they've raised rates over the years, they raise rates fairly quickly and they actually drop them fairly quickly. What they don't do is, once they have an inflection point, they don't change quickly. So when the Fed funds rate was, you know, down to virtually zero, it stayed that way for a long time, years. And also when it's at the peak, it stays that way, not as long as it does when it's at the bottom, but at the peak, it still stays flat for, you know, several months. So, you know,
so when are we hitting the peak?
Well, that's the question. I mean, are they going to raise it again? Or are they not? You know, so what this graph that I showed was, there were like, I think, four peaks that preceded where we are today in whatever the time period of this was, which I think went back to like the 90s or something. And there was one peak that lasted for like 5.5 months before they started dropping. And two others were at like 7 to 8 months, and one was 14 and a half months before they started dropping. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the nice thing will be, if they stop raising the Fed funds rate, that will show some stability, but that doesn't mean they're going to immediately start dropping the rate either. They may just let it sit there for a while.
To season for a while.
Something like that.
Okay. So a quick question, say a bank comes in and says, you know, I'm calling your note, it's time. How far will they go to work with that owner? And I realize this is a one-off question. It depends on the banker. It depends on the building owner. But say the banker says, you know, your rent roll is just too low. You need to get more people in at a higher rate, but your building isn't of that quality. I'll loan you enough money to do the TIs to get your rent roll up if you guarantee this. Will any of that type of horse trading go on, or?
You know, I think that's going to be a really hard situation, and it's going to be on a case-by-case basis.
Yeah.
And, you know, I got to give a shout out to First Service Solutions, which was the sponsor of the webinar that I watched recently. And they talked about 7 possible options for a landlord owner of a building with a loan coming due. And I'll just run through these real quick. Option one is just keep the loan current, just keep paying on it, and don't let it go just don't do one of the other 6 options. Just keep it current.
Well, what if it's a balloon note?
Well, so then that's where extend and pretend comes in. So that's,
it sounds like my waistline.
So we'll get to that in a minute. So, this also applies to not just loans that are being, that are coming up for expiration. It's also for the loans that may be underwater or slightly underwater, where the net operating income of the building is not even servicing the debt. Mm-hmm. So continuing to keep the loan current, while that may sound bad because you're having to fund extra payments every month, compared to having to come up with a bunch of money for that buy down of the equity, you know, adding equity to buy down the loan to value ratio, where you have to do it all at once, this may be the better solution for some situations. Especially, let's say your loan doesn't expire until 2025 or 6. You know, if you look at what the negative is between now and then, mm-hmm. it may still be less than the negative that you have to give if you were to refi. So that's one option. Option two is to sell the property if you can find a buyer. Option number three is to extend the loan. And that's where the extend and pretend comes in, where, you know, you and your landlord, your lender, get together and pretend like it's a good loan and just kick the can down the road. Yeah. And you hope that by the time it expires at that point, things will be better. Rents have gone up, occupancy's gone up, rates have come down. Number four is an AB structure, which I thought this was really interesting. So you basically create two tranches of loans. You have your primary loan to whomever, you know, see a commercial mortgage-backed security, to a bank, to life insurance, whomever. So you have that for whatever that 55% loan-to-value ratio is. And then you have a secondary loan. And that secondary loan is sort of what they called the hope loan, because you hope that you get your money back. And of course, you're going to have a much higher interest rate on that. But the primary loan is your sort of preferred equity, if you will, almost. I mean, it's debt, but they're in the first position. They get paid off before anybody else. Then if that gets paid off, then the hope loan gets paid off if they were to refinance or sell it in the future. And so that structure is kind of interesting. It's really no different than a lot of the ways real estate has been financed in the past, because you've always had what they call the capital stack. You have your equity, you have your loan, you may have a, you know, mezzanine loan, which is just a fancy way of saying you got a second mortgage. So this is really no different than that. It's just being done in a context of a crumbling market and a difficult. So, you know, for whoever's going to be in that second position on the second loan, they're probably going to want returns that are going to be a lot bigger than what a first position lender would require, something more like what equity would expect. Option five was a future discounted payoff. And number six is just a discounted payoff. So both of those are sort of a short sell, where you're basically saying, I owe $100 million. Here, lender, I'll give you, you know, $80 million. And you take the hit on the 20. It's just a question of, are you negotiating for that to occur in the future when it sells some at some point? And in a way, it's kind of a extend and pretend, but with a, you know, a recognition of things are bad and values aren't where they ought to be. Whereas a discounted payoff is just do it now. And then number seven is hand back the property, either through deed in lieu of foreclosure or true foreclosure. And so those are the seven possible options that First Services Solutions suggested as being possibilities for owners of buildings.
I like that. That really covers the waterfront of what's available to you. Well, I shouldn't say that. What's available? What's available to you will depend on the situation you're in, the product type you have, what part of the country you're in, who your friends are. Do you know the mafia? I mean, you know, there's lots of variables.
You got to find a willing lender in all this case, in all these situations, and you've got to find willing equity investors. And I had lunch today with a friend, and he has a client who's in the process of buying an office building, the office building where he happens to office. But he didn't say specifically what percentage of the building his client occupies, but I didn't get the sense that it was 51%, which would be what is required for an owner-occupied loan. And those are still, you know, fairly easy to get if you're willing to pay the interest. But he was saying that this client of his has this building under contract, and I know the building, and I said, and I know who the seller is and who the previous owner was. And I said, all right, so my guess is you're probably talking about $90 to $110 a square foot on the purchase price. And he said, try low 80s. And I was like, oh my goodness.
Was it a log cabin?
It was a lean-to.
Gosh. Yeah. That won't cover carpet and paint.
Well, the thing that was amazing to me is he said that they have this thing under contract. It, you know, it definitely pencils at that number, which, you know, I would hope it would. But the crazy part is, last week I toured a client through an industrial building where the asking price was $225 a square foot. So you're here now. This is not a nice office building. It's you know, B minus, C plus, maybe.
I'm just wondering if it has indoor plumbing. At that price.
But it, you know, what's the value of it? I mean, right. If you don't have people to go in it, you're not you don't think rents are going to go up. And it's not in a bad area. I mean, it's actually in a pretty, I would say a decent area, but I told him, I said, that's a great buy. Tear it down, build industrial, sell it for $225 a foot. That's, yeah, it was crazy.
Well, thanks for your gems of wisdom today. I think we'll be revisiting this topic a lot in the years to come.
Well, speaking of that, I'm sorry, let me give you one other reason why we're going to be talking about this. Okay. Back to the stats in this from the CBRE guy. Mm-hmm. He says that they're predicting peak vacancy, you know, they're mm-hmm. That's going to peak out late 24, early 25. So if it's early 25, which may be a bit optimistic, again, recognizing they get a lot of revenue from rent landlords. But assuming it's early 2025, that's 2 years away still. And so, you know, everybody's been talking about the loans that are expiring over the next, you know, 18 to 24 months. I think we're going to have to be looking at a little farther than that.
I do too. I think it starts now. Can't tell you when it ends. But thanks for listening to us again. As always, we appreciate your comments, your thoughts, your followings, your liking, your reposting. What have I left out? Hashtag.
Sending cash. Just
sending cash. That's right.
Yeah, sending cash is always good. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Thank you for listening. And just a reminder to send in questions to see if we can stump Bob.
Good luck.
We really appreciate your taking the time to tune into this episode. We would love it if you can give us a 5-star rating on whatever platform you're listening to this on. And if you're on our YouTube channel, we would love to read your feedback in the comments section. Also, be sure to subscribe so you get notified when we publish new episodes. Thanks, and we'll see you next time.
Bye.